Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. Good morning. Good to see you all. I hope you're all well. We are up to Daf Zayin today. And we're beginning at the bottom of Vav Amud Bet, six lines up toward the end, Amar Baba Omer Eimatai. In terms of just laying out what this stuff is going to look like, thankfully this week I'm giving you one sheet double-sided so you get a sense of exactly what will be on the daf. And we aim to conclude at the end of Zayin Amud Bet at the bottom, the last line in the middle, Me'ikara. There are, as you'll see, primarily three colors on this sheet. You've got green, yellow, and the kind of pink, orange, brown, beigey thing. And when things are a distinct unit but connected thematically, I've tried to use the same color but a little darker to show that there's an intensification or a parenthetical remark, but it's connected. And there are, even though there are three primary colors, actually I think there's more than that many primary colors, but there are three primary colors on this sheet. You've got green, yellow, and this orange. There are essentially two main sections, and the yellow is all parenthetical, which is kind of a stream of consciousness reflection on something that comes up. But there are two themes that will emerge over this daf. The first is a sensitivity or an appreciation of visible providence, that how great is it when it rains is going to be the primary question. And there are four moments in Jewish history, in human history, that are connected to the rain in terms of how great it is, which there are many notes along the way that will suggest we tend not to feel this living in the hemispheres in which we find ourselves, that when it rains we tend not to react with the, oh, this is brilliant, amazing, oh, that's irritating, it's wet, even if it looks nice outside and feels cozy in the warm, we tend not to celebrate when it rains quite so much. But there are four key moments. The first is going to be the revival of the dead. There's going to be a debate about whether when it rains, that is as great as when the dead will be revived, or even greater perhaps. There's going to be the second event is going to be Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. Is it even greater when it rains than the event of Matan Torah? And if this comparison seems astonishing, to some degree that shock value is what Chazal are looking for, that we should be, when it rains, we should feel like it's Matan Torah, or even greater than Matan Torah. The third event it's going to compare it to is creation. So if you thought revival of the dead or Matan Torah were kind of distinct moments, everything forms from that moment of creation. And every time it rains, that is the equivalent. And the last is the future salvation. So we've kind of got eschatology, or the beginning of time, the revival of God's will, and the revival of the dead as what we should feel when it rains, as a debate among Chazal, how great. That's going to be the first section. In the middle of debating whether this is as great as Matan Torah, you've got that yellow section, which is Chazal reflecting on how does education work? And there's going to be a lot of connectivity between the metaphor of rain and education put in a single line. It would be that education is a form of cultivation. It's not just a disclosure of information. It's not just a transfer of details, but it takes a huge amount of effort, both as a teacher and as a student, for education to work well, in the same way that just because it rains doesn't mean things are going to grow. You have to cultivate the ground. You have to make sure it's not overwatered or underwatered. It takes a huge amount of effort, and education comes up as we compare rain to the giving of the Torah in that reflective way. Then we go over the page, and we've got the orange, which is kind of pivoted by the pink into the orange. I tried to make the color similar. By the way, if anybody's colorblind, I really do apologize. I don't know if that makes a big difference to seeing this, but I know there are different kinds of colorblindness as well. Forgive me. But then we've got, after we've been sensitized to visible providence, meaning we see rainfall, we see it with our eyes, and we may be desensitized to the divine attention that implies, so we're sensitized to that. The second thing is we're sensitized to invisible providence, meaning when it doesn't rain, we don't see anything, and we are to pay attention. If it doesn't rain, what does that indicate for Chazal so far? What does that seem to indicate?
Displeasure.
Displeasure, divine displeasure. If it doesn't rain when it's meant to, and then we're going to have a suggestion of nine possible reasons why it hasn't rained. And it's going to sound eerily like some of the comments we get today when something horrific happens and people will say, oh, that is because people talk in shul, or that is because women aren't dressed modestly enough in the modern world, whatever it is, and we tend to react with that, like, who told you that? How do you know that? And why, how can you blame someone talking in shul for 9/11? It's an astonishing thing to do, and people who do that tend to point back at Chazal and say, well, look, they did it, which of course leaves us to somewhat of a quandary, which there are multiple ways to address, but we'll start by suggesting that Chazal were not averse to tying particular sins to particular traumas, tragedies, invisible providences. I would note that's on the discrete level, that members of Chazal will quite want to do that. But if you think about writ large what the Gemara is presenting for us, what the redactors of the Talmud are presenting, is actually a picture of murkiness when it comes to providence, meaning there are seven suggestions, very hard convictions as to what the reason was. And the Gemara says, well, here are seven. We don't know what it is. So we kind of get that image that it's not unreasonable to tie providence to events and to see divine displeasure, but it may be unreasonable to say, I know with certitude precisely what it is. So that's the image that comes in totality. Those are the two main things. How great is rain? Visible providence we are attended to. And then how terrible is it when it doesn't rain? And how we ought to account or reflect upon ourselves when that happens. So let's start. And we've got this tiny bit of orange left over from last week, the bottom of Vav Amud Bet, and I'm doing this in reverse order. So let's summarize very briefly what we did last week, which is we're still now in the second Mishnah. The first Mishnah was, when do we start Mashiach Baruch HaGeshem? The second Mishnah is, when do we finish the Ten Talamata? And again, we could resolve that issue very, very straightforwardly. When do you stop the Ten Talamata? The Mishnah resolves it very straightforwardly. Two views, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. One view is at the end of Pesach. One view is at the end of Nisan. And the Gemara could have said, who do we follow? A or B, or maybe neither. And at C, we stop the Ten Talamata at the beginning of Pesach. And then that's the end of it. And what the Chazal seem to be doing is we can't even address that halachic question without unpacking some of the theological background here, which is, to some degree, like this Thursday night, I'll be starting my series on animal rights in Jewish life, which in theory you could resolve in 10 minutes. The question of Tzar Balei Chaim, get to what's the source, what's the conclusion? I mean, one of the triggering questions is going to be, if there's a fly in my house, can I kill the fly? And again, I could resolve that question halakhically very simply or straightforwardly or quickly, but it takes time to build up what are the presumptions involved. What is the theological background? What are the biblical context and sources? And that's what Chazal are doing here. And so if anybody ever says Chazal weren't involved with ethics or theology, they were kind of halachic minutia was their main thing. The Gemara testifies quite the opposite, that they spend a huge amount of time when they see a Mishnah saying, what is the background? What are the presumptions, the theology, before we get to the halacha? So we are not going to resolve the question today, by the way, of when you stop saying the Ten Talamata. We're probably not going to resolve that for a couple of weeks. But that is the background. When do I stop saying this? Before I tell you, the Chazal is saying, before I tell you when we stop, you need to know that when you stop, what you're acknowledging. You're acknowledging how great rain is and that you pray for it and that's real and you need it and that reflects a deep desire on the part of humankind. And when you stop, you're saying, I don't want it anymore. And if it continues, I have to face up to the fact that it's not just technically I've stopped davening and I move on with my life, but if it now rains, I've confessed I don't want it anymore, and there's something wrong, and I need to do something about it. So that's what the Gemara is unpacking. Bottom of Vav Amud Bet, if you don't have it, I apologize, it's just a couple of lines. Amra Babar, Rabbi says, Ma'ema time of Achin Alag Shamin, when do we say a bracha on rain? Do we say bracha on rain? Yeah, correct. We tend not to. Should we? Who knows? It's a debate in the Mishnah Berurah whether we should say it or not. And the suggestion is that if we leave in areas in Europe or North America where rain is quite prevalent and reasonably predictable, we don't have a bracha to say on rain. But if you're in an area of the world where rain really is an event worthy of celebration, there are bracha that you say. Maybe in Israel you do say a bracha. There's a debate about whether you say a bracha. And there are suggestions you should say it without God's name in it, because we don't really know. But there is a real bracha for when it rains. We just have, it's fallen out of our ritual vernacular because we're so we've been dispersed into rainy places. So the question is, when do you say the bracha on rain? Mishasachatan likrat kala, when the bride goes out to meet, or when the groom goes out to meet the bride. What on earth does that mean? You say bracha on rain when the bride goes out, when the groom goes out to meet the bride. What does that mean? Good question. Rashi's got two possible suggestions. So some of you who've seen weddings may notice that when the music is playing, firstly, they've got like the Lion King music and all the kids come down throwing flowers and everybody says, oh, so cute. And then the bride comes down. And then many grooms have a practice. When the bride comes down, they'll step out of the chuppah to meet her and then bring her in. And that's not just a fond romantic gesture, that's a halachic practice to go out and kind of bring the bride under the canopy together as a gesture of going in as one as a family. So the presumption Rashi says that this is a metaphor, that the chatan going out to meet the bride is when it rains so much that puddles have emerged on the ground, so that when raindrops hit, what happens? It bounces back up. So when the rain has rained so much, you start to get splashes going up. So the chatan comes up to meet the bride. And this marital metaphor builds on what we said last week when we were defining what Yora means, what Malkush means, and what Revia means, which is that there's some sort of marital connection between the rain and the ground in a kind of almost literal way. It does impregnate the ground, and there is a resultant growth. Peru Revu is a metaphor that is about organic reproduction, and that happens with the ground. So that's his metaphor. Another suggestion is that when it rains so much that different streams emerge and they start to come together. Either way, it's a reasonable amount of rain when you start to say a bracha. My mevarach, what is the bracha? Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Rav Yehuda Amar Rav says, Ma'adam Menach Melach Hashem Elokeinu Kol Tipa V'Tipa Sharat Lanu. I thank you, God, over every single drop that you bring down for me. And again, this is trying to attune us to not just, oh, it's raining, fantastic, but God is paying attention to every single drop, and we're trying to, or Chazal is trying to, attune us to providential details. Rabbi Yochanan Masayim Bahachi, Rabbi Yochanan would finish it in the following way. Ilu pinu male shira kayam. Anyone recognize this? Oshonenu rinak among galav. This is from Nishmat, which we say Shabbat morning or Yom Tov morning or Seder night. And we go through that paragraph until ad al yazveir rachamach Hashem lakenu velo yazvur baruch rov ha'odaot. And we finish by saying, blessed are you, God, rov ha'odaot over, what does rov mean? The majority. Or multitude is a good solution. It sounds like he's saying over most, rov ha'odah, most of the thanksgivings we owe you. Rov ha'odah, v'lo kol ha'odah, you only owe the most and not all. Amar Rava, ima ha'odah. So say, kel ha'odah, meaning God of thanksgiving. We don't have to define it quantitative. Amar Papa, Papa says, now we're on to the single sheet. Neymar tavahu, so we'll say both of them. Kel ha'odah, v'o rov ha'odah. We finish by saying God of thanksgivings. And now we can say rov doesn't mean majority, but it means multitude, over many thanksgivings. Okay, full stop. Now we're on to our daf today. Section 1, how great is rain? Amar Baba Rabbi says, Gadol yom gshamim t'chiyat hametim. When it rains, that is even greater, min t'chiyat hametim, than the revival of the dead. Why? I mean, we could suggest all sorts of reasons. Revival of the dead, we can compare in the sense of you're reviving something that has declined or decayed, and when you bring rain, you bring up seeds and you bring back the ground. You are reviving the dead. How is it greater? Because revival of the dead only applies to the righteous. They'll come back to life. But when it comes to rain, rain feeds everybody. Which is a matter of debate. How is Chiyat HaMeidim going to work? And when we do when we get up to the rabbinic strata of literature in the Jewish afterlife series, we'll talk about what did Chazal say about Chiyat HaMeidim. Does it come up in the biblical text? That's going to be in the sages' material, we'll see. But that's the assumption. Rain is even greater because it's applied broadly, which indicates either divine mercy or God's choice to not pay attention to where the rain falls. It goes for everybody. Pliga de Rav Yosef, Demar Rav Yosef, and this disagreed Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef said, Mitoch shish kula t'chit ha-meitim, kavu b'tchit ha-meitim. So actually, the reason we say Mashiv Avud HaGeshem in the morning and in the evening and Adavning in the bracha of Atah Gibor t'chit ha-meitim is because they're equivalent. It's not just a useful place to put it in. So now, why do I say Mashiv Avud HaGeshem in the middle of t'chit ha-meitim? Not just a convenient moment, we've got to say it quickly, but actually, thematically, rain is like revival of the dead. And he says, because it's shkula, it's equal to it. So now we're debating whether it's greater than it or equal to it, but it's pretty significant when it falls. Amar Rav Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda says, Gadol yom gshamim kayom shenitna b'Torah. The day of rain is kayom shenitna b'Torah, is the equivalent of the revelation of Torah. How do I know? Shneimar, there is a pasuk that says, Yarov kamatar likhi, that may my lekach fall down like rain. What is a lekach? Ein lekach ela Torah. Lekach means a teaching, and teaching means Torah. Shne'emar ki lekach tov natati lachem torati el ta'azavu. So we now have our network of psukim again to define these terms. A lekach is a teaching which is like Torah. So Torah falls like rain. So you might just kind of in a minimal way say, oh, so rain, just like Torah, is kind of life-giving, moral teaching is life-giving. But it's saying, no, it falls like rain, meaning matan Torah, the revelation of God's will, is the equivalent of rain, which, again, is asking us to see every time it rains as the equivalent interruption of the status quo as God speaking to a people, which was an inimitable moment. But rain, we tend to imagine, is part of nature. Water evaporates, it falls where it falls, and that's it. It's saying every time it rains, you have to imagine that God is not just maintaining the cycle of nature, but is intervening into our lives to offer us something that indicates our worth and our responsibility. That's the assumption. And he says it's the equivalent. And how do I know? Because it's compared. Yarov kamat elechi, may my teaching fall like rain. Now, that's based on a biblical proof text. One of the sages is going to say, Rava Amar, first word on the line is Amar, third line before it gets dark green. Yoter meyom shenit nabatar. No, it's actually even greater. How do I know it's greater? Just from metaphorical logic. If I were to say, oh, my teaching is going to fall like rain, which in the two of the metaphors is the more important one? If I say it's going to, my teaching will fall like rain, which of the two are we saying is greater? Rain, why? That's what he's going to suggest. In theory, you could say, well, which metaphor means they're equal. But he's hanging one on the other in his words. How do I know? Rain will fall, my teaching will fall like rain. Mean it leba me. Which one is being compared to which? Of course, usually you say the smaller one, because you're trying to big up how important it is. You say, well, this small thing is just as good as this thing, although maybe not as big. So saying teaching will fall like rain makes rain even greater. Now into the dark green, where because we mentioned that pasuk and we've suggested that rainfall is like the revelation of Torah, we now have this huge side note about the value of Torah, what it means to be a good student, what it means to be a good teacher, how to cultivate one's learning, be a good educational model, and be a good living mentor. Rava Rami Kativ, Rava compared to psukim, actually from the same pasuk, Yarov kamata lechi, it says at the beginning of that pasuk in Ha'azinu, may my teaching fall like rain, uktiv tizal katal imrati, and it says, and may my sayings emerge like dew. Now, a dew and rain, they're just watery metaphors usually, but based on our previous experience in Tanit, are they the same thing? Do we have to pray for both of them? No, tal, we said, never stops. Water can stop. The instruments of providence work very differently, and they emerge very differently. One kind of is gentle on the ground. Nobody ever wakes up in the morning and says, oh my gosh, look how much dew there is. It's terrible. It's kind of a standard amount of dew. You can't really get flooded by dew. You get flooded by rain. So he says, well, which one is it? Im tam chacham hagunhu, if it is an appropriate sage, katal, learning Torah will be like dew, meaning it will land on them gently, it will help refine them, it will keep them fresh in many ways, in love, but if they're not an appropriate scholar, if they're a bad teacher, or a fool, it will break them like rain. Meaning if you're not an appropriate scholar and you learn Torah, it is going to smite you, it's going to break you to pieces. So being a sage, being a scholar, doesn't define you as a good person, per se. We're now saying there is a moral component to what it means to being a scholar. Tanya Ham Rabbana said, Omar, he said, in this teaching, Kola Osik B'Torah Lishma, whoever studies Torah Lishma, what does Lishma mean? For its own sake, meaning with good intentions. Torah To Naset Lo Samachayim, your Torah will be a life-giving elixir. It will keep you alive. Shnema Eitzchayim Hilam HaChazikim, but as it says, the Torah is a living tree for those who hold on to it. Va'omer, and more than that, it says, Rafa'oti l'sharecha, it will be a healing, l'sharecha, for your core being. It really means your navel, but it means like your core being. It will sustain you. Va'omer kimot samasachayim, and it also says, if you find it, you will find life. All that is said about Torah. So if you learn Torah l'shma, it will give you life. But, v'chala osek Torah shelo l'shma, whoever learns Torah, what's lo l'shma? Not for its sake. Meaning, if you're learning Torah because you like bagels, or whatever, that's what it sounds like, right? Nasit lo sam hamavet. It will be an elixir of death. It will be a toxin, a poison. Shne'emar yav kamata lichi, because it says it will fall down like grain. Now, ya'arof doesn't just mean to fall. It's got a very particular connotation. It's a hard fall. Ve'in arifa ila hariga. Arifa is a kind of death. How do I know? Where do we know the word arifa or arufa from? The egla arufa. What does arufa mean in that context? The egla arufa means the calf of the broken neck. My 8th grade Rebbe wouldn't have liked that I did that. He taught us korbano, and he said, never ever do that on yourself, never do an impression of killing yourself. Sorry about that. That we do. So arufa is a violent image. Okay, so we've now established that there are ways to be a good scholar and a bad scholar. There is a question that emerges out of this. Is it good or bad to learn Torah Shelo Lishma? Well, we just said it's bad, but generally we say, right, if you do something lo lishma, you do it not for its own sake because you like bagels, great, because that'll lead you eventually. You'll say, you know, well, bagels are good, but I'm enjoying Torah as well. So it seems a little bit at odds with this piece that if you're doing something lo lishma, it's terrible.
Mutually exclusive. One is until you talk shelo lishma, lo lishma. When you get to that point, then you're doing a good thing. Until then, you're not.
Interesting. So some have made that observation.
Is it neutral or is it actually negative?
Oh, so these are the two readings, right? Meaning one is, yeah, it is good strategically to do Shelo Lishma because it will lead you to do Lishma, but it's not a good thing in the meantime. That's one reading. The Gemara where it actually says Lo Lishma, Bo Lishma makes it sound like Lo Lishma is good strategically. So one reading actually, Tosfot here at the top of the page on the left, he's the first word of the daf is Vikasha. Says, I don't get this. This is the top response from Tosfot. How can you say Lo Lishma is a sam hamavet? It's a poison. Meaning, I can't imagine taking poison is a strategically good idea in terms of your health. Although, of course, some medications, if taken too much of, can kill you. There are toxins like that. But his tradition, there are two kinds of Lo Lishma, which basically, along the lines of Zachary, is that there is Lo Lishma, meaning I'm doing it because I want people to call me rabbi. I'm doing it because people want to say, oh, he does daf yomi. I want people to say things, you know. And that's Lo Lishma, which is kind of, I guess, narcissistic or whatever it is. That's one kind of Lo Lishma. But then there's Lo Lishma, which is, in his words, Hainu, the last line, Misha Lomed Lakanta, someone who does it for corrupt purposes, meaning they want to corrupt the Torah and they want to kind of subvert the whole purpose of Torah. So one is kind of so Lo Lishma, you know, for my own reasons, and one is I've got particular agenda. That is when it becomes a poison for them and a toxin for them. Torah, again, like rain, Torah is not just beneficence that falls. It all depends on how we cultivate and how we use it and use it responsibly. Now we're into the yellow.
Have we gone to a distinction between Matar and Geshem? Is there a distinction? Matar and Geshem are basically synonymous.
So we are treating them as synonymous. We've not actually dealt with it in the Gemara, but we kind of noted it in passing that they're between Matar and Geshem on the first stuff, but it's not hasn't been addressed yet. It's a good question. Now, we're into the yellow, where we're now going to get into... So if you were doing a seminar on rabbinic pedagogical ethics, you would have to read through this and suggest, what is it saying a student needs to behave like, a teacher needs to behave like, how do we treat Torah material? So Amar Rabbi Yirmiya Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Yirmiya said to Rabbi Zeira, Leiti mar litni, teach me something, my friend. Amale, he says, Chalash libay v'lo yichalni. He says, look, I'm not feeling great. I can't really do it right now. And again, if you're redacting this text, in theory, that's not necessary detail. Just say what he taught. So they're trying to humanize these figures as well in many ways. So Rabbi Zeira said, look, I'm not feeling great. I can't really teach you. So Lema mar milta da garata. How would you translate that? Say again? So tell me some agarata, implying?
Tell me a story.
Right. And this is the way many read. It's like, oh, so if you're not feeling well, so tell me some agarata. You know, we all know agarata is not serious. It doesn't take a lot of energy. So tell me that. So I prefer not to read it that way. Otherwise, what we're about to do for the rest of the daf is like story time. Clearly, agarata is important. But he's saying it takes a different kind of energy. And actually, maybe if you say something from a garita, what's it going to do? It's going to make you feel better. You know, halakha is a requirement of Jewish life and how to live. And if that takes too much energy, meaning it weakens you more, say some agarata. Maybe it'll, you know, build you back up. And that's what the Gemara is doing. Before we address when you finish Ten Telemata, let me strengthen your energies with some of why we do this. So he responds, Amalei Hacha Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says as follows, my initiative, why does it say what it says, when it says, Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh, that a person is a tree of the field. And this is in Devarim. V'chi Adam Eitz HaSadeh, is it a person is really a tree? What is this metaphor? And we can have all sorts of metaphors. People are compared to trees. People are compared to iron weapons. People are going to, Torah is compared to fire and water and wine and milk. I'm going to go through what are all these metaphors doing in a particular term and how can we use them and harness them in our educational outlook. So why is a person compared to a tree? Elam Mishum, it is because of what follows in those psukim. And this is in the context of war in Devarim when it says if there are trees, are you allowed to cut down trees in war? Depends on the kind of tree. What kind of tree can you not cut down? Fruit tree. Does that pertain only to war or generally in life? Generally in life, we're not allowed to cut down. Somebody wrote to me an email last year saying, I've got a fruit tree in my garden. It's not producing fruit anymore. Am I allowed to cut it down? And there are all sorts of discussion. Are you allowed to cut down fruit trees that are not productive? What happens if it's going to fall on your house? I had a surveyor come before we moved into the house. And of course, they say you should cut down every tree within a mile of your house for insurance purposes, all sorts of things. I'm like, okay. But am I allowed to cut things down if they're going to damage my house? All sorts of questions emerge. So these are the details. If it is a tree you can eat from, you cannot cut it down. And then it says, but these trees you shall cut down. Why is that important? Because, ha-ketzad, what does this mean? Im tamin chacham ha-gunhu, mimenu tochal ve'lo-tolichoret. If this is an appropriate sage or scholar, learn from them. Don't cut them down, don't cut them out. Ve'im lav oto tashchit ve'karet. If they're not good, don't learn from them. So again, this is educational philosophy on the part of the student. Who should I seek out learning from? Somebody who's an appropriate teacher. Now, we're not given the rubric of what's appropriate, what isn't appropriate, but it does enter into our vernacular that we shouldn't just think, oh, someone's a Talmid Chacham, they know Shas back to front, I could go learn from them. There is the notion that there is a moral dimension to what it means to be a mentor, which, of course, is left for us to glean from elsewhere. Rav Rebbe Chama says, in the name of Rebbe Chanina, my dichtiv, bazel bazel yachad, why does it say that iron sharpens iron? This is in Mishlei. Lo malachat, to tell you, ma bazel ze echad mechadet el chaveru, just as when it comes to iron, you sharpen iron with iron. I don't know how many of you have got knife sharpeners at home. Any of you got knife sharpeners at home? We don't. We just have a lot of blunt knives. So just as you use iron to sharpen iron, av shnei tam lechacham mechadin zet zebalachai. Two sages sharpen each other. And this is used often in yeshiva when they try to advocate finding a chevruta, which of course they know you just spend a lot of time schmoozing with, but they say you should have a chevruta because learning together you sharpen each other. And this is, of course, not just for the Talmud, this is for Talmidei Chachamim. This is saying sages ought to speak. And in fact, anyone heard of the book My Uncle the Netziv? It was a controversial book when it came out, published by Art Scroll. It was actually a biography written by his nephew, which is why it's called My Uncle, the Netziv, who was an esteemed figure in his own right. His nephew was the author of the Torah Tamima. We study what he writes, but it became controversial because he said some terrible things about the Netziv. What was one of those terrible things? He read newspapers on Shabbos, and so we can't read this anymore. And of course, as soon as it was banned, well, sales went up, and you can now find it on Amazon for like $4,000 a copy or something. Indeed, but one of the things in it Siv is reported to have said by his nephew is that the reason that Rambam made mistakes in this Mishneh Torah was because he did it in isolation. He didn't sit around with a group of students and he did it in isolation, which some people say, I don't really trust this anecdote, he doesn't really point to any mistakes in the Mishneh Torah, but there is this sense that even great sages need to be in a seminar with others. Rabbi Chama says, why is it compared to fire? It says the Torah is like fire. What is that meant to tell you? Fire isn't really good. It can hurt you. What does it tell you? Just as you can't light a fire with one stick, you need a flint or two sticks, you need something to get it going, so to Torah, ein mekayim b'chimidi, it doesn't sustain itself in a single person. You need other people to sustain this. And this, of course, is important, not just educationally, socially, morally. You need to be in a group of people. I've mentioned this in the past. I remember I asked Rav Lichtenstein before I went out to graduate school, where I was not going to be around, why you revel. I was going to be in New Chicago. I said, what can I do? Looking for some sort of ritual I could do, because he did Mayim Achronim when he went to Harvard as a way to insulate himself. And he just said, find like-minded people to spend time with. And at the time, I remember feeling like, oh, that's a bit disappointing. You know, it's telling me, yeah, if you don't hang out with people, you're going to go off the derech. You know, you should find people to be with. It kind of was a confession of weakness. But this is what the Chazal is suggesting as well. You have to have company, because we all get infected and affected by the people we spend time with. And that's not because we're weak, it's because we're human. We affect people and people affect us. And here, even Talmidei Chachamim, it's like fire. You need to sustain it in the company of other people. That's the assumption here. And this is V'chainu Darim Rabbi Yehoshua B'Chanina. This is the same thing Rabbi Yehoshua B'Chanina said. My dichtiv, why does it say in a pasuk, Cherev al habadim, there is a sword on the boasters, the badim, v'no'alu, and they are foolish. What does that mean? Cherev al sonem shel Talmidei Chachamim. There is a sword hanging over the enemies of sages. Who are the enemies of sages? This is a euphemistic way of talking about Talmidei Chachamim. There is a sword hanging over scholars, Sha'oskim bad bavad b'Torah, who spend their time learning by themselves. V'lo od ela shemitav. So not only is this a dangerous thing to learn by yourself, but it makes you a fool. Shne'emar v'no'alu, because it says in that verse, they are fools as well. And this is all the homiletic reading of badim. Badim means boasters, but bad means alone as well. So if you learn by yourself, it will lead to harm and it will lead to you becoming foolish. V'lo od, not only will it make you foolish, and is it possibly harmful, ela shechotim, but you are sinning. K'tiv hacha, it says in that verse, v'no'alu, k'tiv hatam, and it says, something we repeat in the liturgy of the high holidays, asher no'alu v'shechatanu, that we are foolish and we have sinned. There's a connection between foolishness and sin. V'abayit eimah v'hacha, and if you don't want to go to that verse, there's another verse that says, no'alu sari tzoan, that the Zoanite officers were foolish for Hadaret Mitzrayim, and they took the Egyptians astray. So we get a sense that foolishness is not just an intellectual characteristic, but it also leads to moral problems. Amr of Nachman Yitzchak, Nam Shal Divrei Torah Ka'etz. Why is the Torah compared to wood or trees? How do I know Torah is compared to trees? We've already said, Eitz Chaim Hilam Achazik Yimbay. It is a living tree. Okay, that's a nice metaphor. We're all used to it. What on earth does that mean? The Torah is a living tree. Living trees decorate my garden. What's that got to do with anything? Malamalach to tell you, Ma Eitz Katan Madleget HaGadol, just as a small match can ignite a huge log, so too small sages can ignite a great sage. So this is another metaphor for teachers and for students to recognize that it is not just a dispersal of information that gets transported from the greater sage to the lower sage, but there is a cultivation involved that can be circular from the smaller to the greater. And this is what the famous saying Rabbi Chanina is, I learn very much from my teachers. I learn more from my friends than my teachers. And I learn even more from my students than I did from my friends. Rabbi Chanina says, hold on a minute, let's compare two different verses. Likrat sami hatau mayim. There is one verse that says, take water to greet the thirsty. Meaning, if someone is thirsty, you need to bring them water. Uktiv, and it also says elsewhere, Have, this is both in Yeshayo, but it says much later, Have kol sami lechulamayim, whoever's thirsty should go to water. So here's an ethic, but it's contradictory. If I'm thirsty, should someone bring me water or should I go to water? That's the question. Or if I'm in possession of water, should I bring it to those who are thirsty or should I say, you come here? And I'll give you when you come here. Im Talmid Hagunhu, now it's not Talmid Chacham, but Talmid, if it is a good student, Likrat Same Hato Yumayim, bring water. If somebody you see is a student who is worthy, you as a teacher should go out of your way to train them and mold them and mentor them and teach them. But if they're not an appropriate student, let them come to you. You don't have to go out of your way to go to somebody who is not an appropriate student. But if they come to you, you should still offer them water. We've got a similar contrast set up from Bechanin Rechama, who says, it says in one verse, you should spread out your springs outward, meaning you should share your teaching, your water. And it says elsewhere that you should keep all your water to yourself. If it's an appropriate student, you should spread out your teachings, and if not, keep them to yourself. And here we've got another ethic designed for teachers and those who are aiming to be scholars. Why is Torah compared to water? As you've just said, you've just used mayim as a metaphor for teaching. Why is water a good metaphor? Meaning water has all sorts of associations. Water can drown. Water can give life if we drink it. Water. I mean, what element of water is worthy of thinking about? To tell you, just as water, if you put it in a high place, what happens to it? If it's in a cup, nothing. But if you pour it on a high place, it will fall to the lower place. If you want Torah to be sustaining, if you want it to stay where it is, you have to maintain a lowly sense of self. Otherwise, it's going to travel somewhere else. So again, not only, now we're getting a sense of what it means to an appropriate teacher. We said you've got to be a Talmid Chacham Hagun. And now we're saying part of that Haguna, part of that suitability is having a appropriate sense of self, and that is here, dato shfeila. We'd have to define what it means to have a low sense of self, but not to have a sense of hubris, arrogance, or conceit. And if you see a Torah teacher who exhibits that trait, one is being guided to say, I've got some skepticism around whether I should be shaped by this person if they exhibit those sort of traits. Vam Rabbi Oshia, and now we've got Rabbi Oshia who buttresses the same point. We're going to be a couple of minutes over this morning, I apologize. Rabbi Yosha says, why is Torah compared to these three liquids, to water, wine, and milk? And now we've got the verses to prove that Torah is compared to these things. We've already said Torah is compared to water. You should go and eat and satisfy yourself without free of charge, without silver, without a cost. You should have wine and milk. And this is being compared to Torah teaching. Why is Torah compared to wine, milk, and water? To tell you, just as these three liquids only really last, where would we put them nowadays? If you got wine, anyone keep wine? What happens when you open wine? Yeah, you've got a very limited time to use it, unless you have a proper wine cooler with the, I don't have one, where you've got these settings on it, and it can hold it for a very, very long time. Milk, where do you want to put it? Fridge. It's going to go at some point, but if you don't put it in the fridge, it's going to go much quicker. Water will also go stale if you keep it up for too long, different lengths. So it needs to be b'pachot shebekelim, which in the old days didn't mean in a fridge, but it meant in a earthenware vessel as opposed to what? Metal of some sort. Metal, it's going to go bad much quicker, and some of the taste is going to sour, all sorts of things. After every Torah, in makamel mishadat shvela, so Torah only sustains itself in somebody who is b'pachot mebekelim, meaning I am the fridge of people. Recognize that people stick things in you. You have a utility, and here it's suggesting that you're not that fancy looking. You're not gold and silver embossed with jewels. Anyone ever seen Indiana Jones in the what's that last one? The Last Crusade, is that what it's called? Where at the very end, the last trial is Indiana Jones has to pick which chalice, which cup was the one that belongs to the founder of Christianity, and drink the water. And if you pick the wrong one, you explode, which of course happens to the Nazis. And you've got to pick the right one. And the Nazi comes along and picks the one that's the one with the most beautiful jewels and made of gold. And Indiana Jones, who of course has been educated at the University of Chicago in the movie, says, I know exactly where to look. And he picks the only one that is made of clay, other than when he drinks it. And that's life-sustaining. And of course, Steven Spielberg got that from this Gemara. Where you have to, if Torah is going to be sustaining, it has to be from the lowliest of vessels. And not only is this learned out from Sukkim, we now have an interaction with Caesar himself from one of the sages who's going to prove this point. Kada Amra Le, as it was taught, Brate the case of Shuben Hanana, the Hananya, the daughter of Caesar was speaking to Shuben Hananya, and she was a very pleasant young woman, as you can see from what she said. She says, Oi, Torah is so beautiful, and it's in such an ugly vessel. Talking about what? Him, saying, you are so unattractive. How on earth could we say Torah is in you? It's an astonishing thing for her to say. Well, not that astonishing. She's royalty and he could be beheaded at any time. Amala, what is astonishing is his response. He says, well, Avicha Rami Chamra Bamani de Pachra says, well, your father stores some important things and pretty lowly things. Meaning, you tell me Torah is important. How can he be such an ugly man? Your father, the Caesar, keeps all his wine and all the earthenware vessels. And she responds by saying, Amrale Elabamai Nemre, what should he store it in? What do you mean? Good point. Amrale Atun de Chashvita Ramab Mane de Havachaspa. Well, if it's really important and he's an important person, he should store all his wine in gold and silver. She says, that's a valuable point. Azlava Amrale Lavu, she goes and tells her father, Ramlacham Ramane de Havachaspa, you should store it all in silver and gold. And of course, what happens? V'takif, it all goes bad and sour. Atu va'amrule, all the servants went and told Caesar, oh, I'm really sorry, your wine is all spoiled. Amrala levratesh, he tells his daughter and says, man amala hachi, who told you to do this? Amrale, Rabbi Shua ben Chananya. He said it was Rabbi Shua ben Chananya told me to do this. He now risks getting in a lot of trouble. Karyuhu, so he is called to come to the Caesar. Amarle, and he says to him, Amai Amad Lahachi, why did you tell my daughter to store all this wine and gold and silver? Amarle, Sir Bshua Chananya says to Caesar, Ki Hecha da Amarle, Amre La. What she said to me, I said to her. Meaning she told me, Torah's so beautiful, how can you store it in such an ugly vessel? So I said, if wine's so beautiful, how can you store it in an ugly vessel? And now Caesar says, hold on a minute. This whole metaphor doesn't work. You're telling me Torah only gets preserved in lowly vessels, because what happened when I put the wine in good vessels? It went bad. So what is the logical conclusion of that? If Torah is in... Torah is an ugly vessel, it's okay. Why don't I put Torah in a beautiful vessel? It should spoil. And he said, hold on a minute, I know some pretty good-looking Talmidei Chachamim. What do you mean? You're telling me that it only gets preserved in ugly vessels? V'ha'ikha shapiri digamiri. I know some very beautiful people who are learned over the page, and here we have a controversial moment. Ihavu sano, if they were ugly, tvei havu gamiri, they would be even more learned. And this is what it sounds like, that if the good-looking sages, if you think they're well-versed, imagine how well-versed they would be if they weren't good-looking. That's the way Rashi reads it at the top here on the left of Zayin Amud Bet. He says, "Otam naim shem chachamim." If those people who were good-looking with sages, if they were ugly, tveyav the gemiri she efshal lenael hashpil daato uvalidei shichra, they would be even more learned. Why? Because they wouldn't pay attention to what their hair looks like, or what their face looks like, or their physique. They wouldn't be inclined to do that, so they'd have more time to spend on their study. Tosfot on the previous page, who presumably was of the better-looking variety, said, hold on a minute, what are you suggesting here? The bottom Tosfot on Zayin Amud Aleph says, Perish im hayusonim hayofi. If they hated aesthetics, they would be even more. Not if they were ugly, but if they didn't pay attention to aesthetics, they would be even more well-learned. So you've got a debate there. Devar Acher, another reason as to why Torah is compared to these three, Mashosh, Mashkan, Lalu, just in these three things, Ein Nifsalin, El Behetzach Hadat, they go bad when you don't pay attention to them. Meaning, if I've taken milk out the fridge and it's off, it's usually because I haven't had any for a while, I haven't thought about it. Usually it's not like, oh, yesterday it was fine and today it's bad. It's usually I haven't paid attention to it. For I'll live to free Torah, Mishtachan Besachadah, so to Torah goes away without attention. And what we've established, we're now going to get a little bit further, what we've established so far, again, is that Torah isn't like wine in the sense that you move it into another thing and it can just hold. It takes cultivation, it takes moral attention to that which is holding it. It's not just information, but if you are, like she says, having such a beautiful thing be in an ugly vessel, means that, well, it needs maintaining. It is like natural organic material that if I don't hold it in a certain vessel in a certain way, it will corrupt and it will spoil. It's not something I can download and it's on. But it really requires attention morally as well, and not just morally, but also it requires attention in terms of time, that if I don't pay attention to it, it will fall away. We're now on to the third. We've only done two ways in which the rain is great so far. Either it is like revival of the dead, or it is like revelation. Aruchama says it's as great as creation itself. It says, Harifu Shamayim Ma'al, that the heavens will pour down from above. Shachakim Yizlu Tzedek. And the skies will rain down. Sedek tiftach aretz, righteousness will come out of the ground. Ve'yifru yesha utzdaka tatzmiach, salvation will sprout out. Righteousness will blossom. Yachad anei Hashem barativ, I alone am God that made barativ it. Having described shamayim and aretz, you would think it would say I created them, shamayim va'aretz. But it says, Baratim, I created it. So the Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina says, Baratim lo nem. Or he doesn't say I created them, but Baratim, I created it, meaning rain. So out of all this panoply of natural references, God is saying the sky, the heavens are great, earth is great, creation is great, and I made it. meaning I made rain, that is the most important thing of the lot. Rabbi Yosha says, Gol Yom Hashem Shafil Yeshua Perovobo says, the day of rain is so great that even the future salvation begins at that time. Shneema Tiftach Eretz V'Yifri Yesha, I will open up the land and salvation will sprout. So we've now established the first part of the daf through the green with our parentheses in yellow. Torah and revival of the dead, creation and future salvation are all tied in our mind, or should be, when we see rain. Rain is not just, oh, it's a Tuesday morning, it's raining, it's going to go up to 55 degrees by midday, but it's raining. This is an important moment in our religious lives where we pay attention to the significance of God's attention to us. Now that we've been attuned to appreciate visible providence, to when it rains, not just think, oh, that's, I'm going to have to put boots on, but, oh, wow, God is paying attention to the negative, which is why it's more in red. The negative side of this, what happens when it's not raining? We'll go to probably about 9:15. We'll see how far we get. Amar Tanchum Achin Lai. Rav Tanchum Amar Lai says, "En Sham Yodim Elim Kenim Chalav Notem Shel Yisrael." So rain only falls, and this is a pivot point because it's still talking about rain falling. Rain only falls if Nimchalu Av Notem Shel Yisrael, if the sins of Israel have been forgiven. So not only when it rains are we meant to be thinking, "Wow, this is like the revival of the dead. This is like the creation of the world. This is like the revelation of Torah. This is like the future salvation." We're meant to think we're forgiven. We're also meant to think, feel a sense of internal relief that it only rains if God has forgiven us. So this is wonderful. How do I know? Shneemar Ratzit Hashem Atzecha. God is appeased by your land. Shevet Shvut Yaakov. He returns the captives or the captives of Jacob. Nasar Avon Amcha Kitzit Kol Chatem Sela. You've forgiven all sins and you've covered up all errors. That's compared to rain. Amle Zeri Medidhavat La Ravina. Zeri of Dihavat says to Ravina, who made who repeated that comment to him, Atan mehacha matnina la, you learn that from here, Anon mehacha matnina la, we learn it from a different verse, Va'atat ishma ha-shamayim salak l'chatat, you in the heavens listen, meaning you make it rain, v'salak l'chatat, when you've forgiven sin. So again, that's kind of in between these two sections, where rain is so great, it's also meant to make us reflect, not just on, this is an astounding historical moment, but personally, this indicates piety on my part. And now we pivot into, okay, now what happens if it hasn't rained? And we still haven't got to, when do I stop saying V'tein Tal Amadar? But before we can say when we stop, we have to understand what it means for us when we don't want it anymore. Amrim Nachum Bereda Rav Chia by Ish Kafo, Ish Kfar Akko. So Tanchum, the son of Rav Chia of Ish Akko says, Einek Shamim Ne'et Sarim Ela Ink, and what I've highlighted in red boxes for you are all the potential reasons for why it might not be raining. And the first suggestion is, rain is held, Shamim Ne'et Sarim, Nitchavu Sonem Shal Yisrael Kliya, if the Jewish people deserve to be destroyed and wiped out. So this is dramatic, meaning if it doesn't rain and it's the rainy season, we should think to ourselves, oh, it's raining, we've been forgiven. It's not raining, not we haven't been forgiven, but we deserve to be wiped out. Shneemar, how do I know? Because there is a verse that said, Tzia, drought, gam chom, and heat, yilgzlu mimei sheleg, steals the waters of snow, sheol chatau, and down to sheol. What is sheol? Yeah, the underworld, we'll get to that in our Shabbat afternoon series, but it's some sort of murky post-mortem place, that's where sinners go. Amle Zirim Yidhavad Ravina, and we have the Iri chirping again and say, Altum Achamanina, you learn it from that, Anam Achamanina, I learn it from here, straightforwardly, every day. Vatsarada Shamayim, I will shut up the heavens, and what? Vavadata Mehira, and you will perish quickly. This is a suggestion that if I'm holding back water, it's because you deserve to be wiped out. And Rav Chisda says, no, it's agriculturally linked. If it's not raining, it's because people are not doing Trum Masa properly, Shneemar, based on the same verse. It said, Tzia Gam Chom, that the drought and the heat, Yigzum Mimei Sheleg, will steal from the waters of snow, which is a rhetorically powerful notion, but it's more specific. My Mashma, what's that got to do with this? Tanad Rav Yishmal, it was taught in the house of Rav Yishmal, Bishvil Drum Shadvidi Yedachem Yimara Chama, because of what I command you at the time of Chama, meaning at the time of Chom, which is to do Trum and Masa during the spring and summer. Lo asitem, and you don't do them, yigzu mikem imei sheleg b'yimalak shamim, I will steal snow waters at the time of rain. Meaning it's not just, oh, drought means that I'm stealing your rain, but drought in the heat season, meaning if you're not getting rain, it's because of what you were told to do in the season of heat, Trum and Masa, and I'm taking rain away from you in the winter. So we now have two reasons. Either you deserve to be wiped out as a people, or you haven't been doing Trum and Masa. Now, those are radically different reasons to suggest what rain not falling is. So we've got a third one. There is another reason. Maybe it's Lashon Hara, which is a good go-to if you're a rabbi trying to pound on a Bible and say why bad things happening. It's Lashon Hara. Why is that a good go-to? Because everyone's doing it all the time. It's an easy one to go to and say, it's called Lashon Harsh, Ne'emar, Ruach Tzafon Decholel Geshem. There's a verse that says, the north wind will bring rain, Upanim Nazamim, but the angry face comes from Lashon Seter, furtive language, which it seems Lashon Hara. Amram Sanram Hanuna Ing Shaman Sun Mishvil Aze Panim. Rav Hanuna says, no, you want to know why, really, why it doesn't rain? What's Aze Panim? Well, Aze Panim is kind of like a brazen faced. I think Art Scroll says impudent.
Impudent?
Or maybe that's the Koran says impudent. But it's meaning it's brazen.
Brazen person.
Brazen person. There you go. Shneemar. How do I know that a brazen face is what leads to no rain? And by the way, what does brazenness mean? It sounds like meaning like, hubris, I'm not interested, I don't have any vulnerability. Meaning rain, no rain, I'll be fine. Meaning somebody precisely who doesn't recognize that we are dependent as beings on other things, that sense of independence is what will lead to a recognition of need on your part. Shneemar, how do I know? It says, Vimnu revivimu malkosh, I will hold back showers of malkosh, so haya, and there will not be the late rains of malkosh. Why? Umetzach isha zona hayalach, because you have the forehead of a harlot. Now, I'm not familiar with the forehead of harlots, but I assume the assumption is that you're brazen, meaning you're comfortable doing something which is less than appropriate and having no shame, meaning you're quite brazen about it. V'amar of Salah, now we've got an aside, which is a little bit darker about brazenness. Amar of Hamnuna, kol adam shesha azat panem, whoever has this brazenness, saf nechshal ba'avera, we know they're going to sin, meaning it leads, hubris leads to sin. And the truth is, in an aside, we see this with politicians all the time. In an astonishing way, people do such corrupt things. You imagine, how could you do something so stupid? But you get to a certain position of power, you feel so invulnerable. You do horrific things, even though you must know that this will come out. You think, I'll be fine. The suggestion is, if you have this brazenness, you will fall in sin. Shneemar, metzach isha zonah hayalach. It says you're going to have the forehead of a harlot. It's not just meaning you're brazen. It means you're going to do something of sexual impropriety. Rav Nachman Amar, no, it doesn't mean you will eventually. It means, b'yadua shenechshal ba'avera. If you're brazen, we know you've already sinned, because it says hayalach in the past tense. Lo eminam halach, not that you will. We're going to end with this orange. Amar Rav Huna says, kol adam sheisho azat panim, mutar likrata rasha. If somebody is brazen, you are permitted to call them a rasha. Wicked. Shneemar, it says, hey, is ish, Rasha Bafanaf, it says a wicked person hardens their face. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak says, Mutar lasnota, you can hate them, meaning there is now a distinction. Someone could be a Rasha and you're still not allowed to hate them. But he's now saying, not only can you call them a Rasha for being brazen, you're even allowed to hate them. How do we know? Shneemar, it says, Ve'ez panim yushuner, the brazen faced changes, meaning it's that you change your face when you're brazen. Altikre yushuner, don't read it yushuner, ela yisana. You shall hate them. Next week we'll charge on and we'll get through that material quickly because we won't need the background. But so far what we've established in the second half is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 potential reasons why rain doesn't fall, which is either you deserve destruction, you haven't been doing agricultural divisions properly, which is maintaining the economy, you've been gossiping, or you've been brazen. And all those things lead us to reflect on, and this side note here, there's been a kind of an undercurrent, no pun intended, some pun intended, to the value of humility, a lack of hubris, recognizing vulnerability as people, which makes us good human beings, because God will feed us rain, but also good teachers, good scholars, because we recognize that Torah needs cultivation characteristically as well. We'll stop there and we'll move on next week.